Chapter 42. December 17th of year 18. We have woven a net of fine metal threads, spreading it through space behind us. So far, so good, I reassure myself. The actual truth is, we really cannot be sure how successful our makeshift sail will be. For one thing, we do not have any experience with this particular technology. In addition, the flare will not come at us directly. It will come from behind and at a slant. The reason for this is that the flare goes straight outward from the star, while we are moving at a tangential course to it. The good news is, we do not have to cruise directly against the wind. But it is not possible to place our sail at an optimal angle. Adam and Eve have strapped themselves into their pilot seats in the command module. They seem very self-assured, but I would like to peer into their minds to see whether they are as calm as they pretend to be.
"What will happen if we gain too much speed?" Adam asks. "I want the truth, Marchenko."
I have asked myself the very same question. According to my calculations, though, we will not exceed the escape velocity of Proxima B. That is not very likely. If it does happen, the planet would not be able to capture us, and we'd have to take another lap, I explain. But that wouldn't be a problem, because we would be back in 16 days and could try again.
Then we could even circle it a third time before the next flare arrives, Eve adds.
We shouldn't push our luck, I caution. I would suggest we find a safe shelter first, on the front side. The other side of the planet, with minus 80 degrees and eternal darkness, is probably not too pleasant. It feels as if I am sitting between Adam and Eve. They talk to me as if I were a real human being, and it's a heartwarming feeling. I sincerely hope it will always stay this way. The sensors registered the flare when it separated from the red dwarf 30 minutes ago. A huge part of the surface initially turned dark, and then we saw this one part being broken from below, as if a huge monster were trying to finally escape from its prison. Every 40 days or so, Proxima Centauri gives birth to a creature made of ions and electrons, which is now hurrying to find a victim. This creature is moving into space following a curved trajectory, as the rotation of the star gives its angular momentum.
X-ray exposure above tolerance level, the automatic system reports. The flares are accompanied by strong X-rays.
I check our course. Another 25 minutes before we reach the shadow of Proxima B. At this moment, the wave reaches us. We do not feel anything, but the sensors go haywire.
It is happening, I say. Adam and Eve stare intently at the monitor, which is already showing the approximate form of the magnetic sail. This display makes it clear where the monster is coming from. It presses and pushes from below and behind at an oblique angle, deforming the lines of the magnetic field. The ship accelerates, and there is an abrupt clinking sound as a previously floating screwdriver now drops to the floor. The sail is working. It propels us and shields us at the same time. We surf above a hot flood measuring millions of degrees. Another 15 minutes.
"Looking good,"
Adam says, as if to encourage himself.
The magnetic sail is bulging more and more. The creature is desperately trying to reach us. This monster is digging into the magnetic field like a puppy into a pillow, and if it continues long enough, the pillow will burst, with feathers flying in all directions. A shadow moves in front of the sun's disk, and the planet is coming in reach.
"Looking very good," I confirm.
We need the magnetic sail to last another 5 minutes.
"Breach imminent,"
the automatic system warns.
It is right. The plasma cloud will reach us in less than a minute. Safety is still 4 minutes away.
Adam's facial expression is emotionless, but his eyes are wide open. Eve is grabbing the armrest of her seat as if preparing for a jolt. The plasma monster will attack us in utter silence.
"Discard magnetic sail," I command.
The automatic system immediately separates the metallic net from the ship. The net no longer receives electricity from messenger, and the charged plasma particles immediately take hold of it. Through self-induction caused by the Lorentz force, they will create a field in opposition to their source. Thanks, Lawrence Force.
We feed the net to the monster, hoping it will choke on it. At least, this will give us a little breather.
1 minute later, the dark side of Proxima B appears above us. Eve raises her arms, and Adam is smiling to himself. The plan worked. The planet protects us, while its front side is being bombarded by radiation. Now we have 40 minutes to decide on a landing spot, prepare, and then start our descent. Or should we wait for another orbit? My opinion is that 40 minutes are more than enough to initiate the landing procedure. We are a highly efficient team.
Shall we land? I ask.
Adam and Eve nod in agreement.
The next question is, where? I ask.
We have four options. The opposite side, the dry central plain, the steppes, or the forest.
The forest is probably the most interesting region, Eve replies.
But it's also the most dangerous, Adam says. Not just for us, but for anyone living there. We don't want to make a bad first impression.
Eve nods and says, if you look at it from that point of view, we might as well be consistent and choose the hot central plains.
I'm not sure, Adam says. Did you see the high mountains surrounding it?
We have 40 days left until the next flare, I remind them. During that time, we can examine each vegetation zone and choose a safe location.
That sounds reasonable, Adam admits.
I agree with them. They did not need me to come to this conclusion. They did not even ask me. I should be glad.
But you don't want to go down in one fell swoop, do you? I ask.
Of course not, Eve says, her tone sounding as if I had asked a bizarre question. First, we're going to circle the planet several times at decreasing altitudes. Remember, we need information about the surface.
It is a sensible plan.
We can only get the necessary overview from orbit, and we are going to need maps that are as detailed as possible. Once Messenger has landed, it will be too late. We are going to use our next orbit of Proxima B to gradually decrease the radius of our trajectory. But the planet won't make that easy for us. Its gravitational force pulls us in 50% more strongly than Earth would, so we cannot compensate for it with our engines, and we would crash. Therefore, we have to employ a two-part landing method. The command module will be separated from the rest of Messenger, which will then be called the orbital module. This way, we will already reduce our mass by 2/3. The ring on the command module, between it and the rest of the spaceship, is about 1 meter thick. The fabricators will completely fill the tunnel leading through it with fireproof material. And then this part can serve as our heat shield. Whatever we are going to need must be moved from the orbital module into the command module. I have everything I need inside my mind. But Adam and Eve start carrying mementos forward. Robot J also moves to the command module. The more independent Adam and Eve have become, the less often we have needed him on board. But now he will become an important helper again, while Adam and Eve adapt to the high gravity. During the descent, strong parachutes will support us, but we will have limited ability to steer and are going to be dependent on wind and weather. Therefore, we cannot choose the exact landing site, and most likely, we will step onto the new planet after a crash landing. If that proves true, it should not matter, as the command module is designed to handle it and remain undamaged. While Adam and Eve move their stuff, I am studying the landscape below us. We are still flying over the far side of the planet, and it is covered by a thick layer of ice. Messenger measures surface temperature between -80 and -90 degrees. The air here contains 15% oxygen, and it is favorably clear. There appear to be no clouds or storms. Clouds might freeze out at these low temperatures, and storms cannot develop either, as there are no energy differences. Our scanners do not reach low enough to tell me what is under the ice. I am tempted to say it is a water ocean. That would make sense. Proxima B is subject to tidal forces that heat up its interior, and this might be one of the reasons its oversized iron core has not solidified yet. At least, the outer layers of the core are liquid. This is indicated by the strong magnetic field shielding the planet. Without that field, those biologists who from the very beginning considered Proxima B uninhabitable would have been right. I would like there to be a water ocean below the ice. I know that is a sentimental idea, coming to me because in a previous life I had the chance to explore the ocean of the ice moon Enceladus. Even though this ultimately cost me my body, I would not want to have missed the time I spent with the pilot Francesca. Perhaps there is even a being here on Proxima B that resembles the one on Enceladus? The planet turns below us. I notice a bright strip crisscrossed by lightning on the right edge of the screen. This must be the zone between the bright side and the dark side, where the direct heat exchange occurs. Low-pressure zones move in from the bright zone and encounter the huge stable high-pressure area over the dark hemisphere. Energy is exchanged via rain, wind, and stormy weather. It is hard to imagine the sun ever shining here. The strip exists in eternal twilight, but according to the spectrometer, it seems to be teeming with life. I detect a large number of organic carbon compounds, and nitrogen, sodium, sulfur, phosphorus, arsenic, hydrogen cyanide, a truly amazing mixture, but it also shows me we have to be careful. The transition zone stretches about 50 kilometers beyond the terminator, the dividing line between darkness and light. An ocean begins beyond it. It looks unusual because it is only about 100 to 150 kilometers wide, yet this ocean stretches around the entire planet. It almost appears as if Proxima B placed a towel made of water around its hips. The ocean does not appear to be very deep, as islands are visible in it. Despite this, it would present a considerable obstacle if we ever attempt to travel from the day side to the night side of the planet. And this body of water is not very suitable for bathing either, not with a temperature of 6 to 10 degrees, not to mention its unknown chemical makeup. Further toward the center of the continent, there might not be any large bodies of water due to the increasing heat, but I see some rivers winding from the interior to the ocean. I have an idea of how the weather cycle might be functioning here. Due to the energy exchange at the terminator, the air masses absorb moisture over the ocean and carry it into the interior of the continent. The warmer the air gets, the more water it can absorb, until the system reaches a tipping point, perhaps caused by dust from the volcanoes on the continent, and then rain falls. Afterward, the rivers carry the water back to the ocean. Indeed, the forests close to the ocean look very humid. While the type of plants cannot be determined from up here, the laser scanner tells me that there is an altitude difference of about 200 meters between the vegetation canopy and the ground. What I refer to as forest, due to all the green, spreads about 200 kilometers wide toward the center of the continent, followed by these steppes. The only thing we know about them is that whatever grows there is not very tall. In this particular situation, it must be an ecosystem in which tall trees are not needed. This predominantly flat zone extends for about 500 kilometers. If we have to reach the trees in order to be safe, that would mean at least 15 days of walking, as I cannot expect Adam and Eve to cover more than 35 or 40 kilometers per day. This theoretical goal is easy for me to formulate, since I would not have to walk it. I will be using Jay as a mobile platform. The steps end in a mountain range that is 4 to 5 kilometers high. I order the sensors to pay particular attention to finding the easiest way across it. The mountains look as if they were created by a huge asteroid impact. Perhaps Proxima B had suffered a fate similar to that of Mercury, where the Caloris Basin indicates an impact that occurred long ago. However, in this instance, the planet's central plain is missing the typical crater mountain in its middle. Could erosion have destroyed such a mountain? Perhaps it simply melted, because it is hot here, tremendously hot. We must be careful not to land too close to the middle of the continent. It would be best if we aim for a location not too far from the outer edge of the central plain. At the spot where the sun is directly overhead, the ground must have actually melted in the past, since it has a glassy, smooth structure now. If given the opportunity, I would like to take a closer look at this area sometime. By now, Messenger has reached the far side again. Adam and Eve are strapped into their seats. I am unsure if they are aware of a vital step that is still missing. We have to say farewell to the incubation chamber. The virtual incubation chamber system is almost an AI. It will now be needed to control the orbital module, with which we will have no contact for a long time. I broach the subject with both of them. Do you want to say goodbye to the incubation chamber? Eve gives me a shocked look in reply. The term incubation chamber does not sound in the least poetic, but something stirs in her. I can see it, and I understand it well. I am not so sure about Adam. He is better at hiding his emotions, or maybe he is just trying to do so to fit the ideal masculine role he thinks he should be playing. I have consciously attempted to avoid presenting them with stereotypical roles. The incubation chamber took care of them from the stage of the first cell division, fulfilled their needs, and often comforted them with words. As it was not equipped with feelings, the chamber's virtual intelligence must have been a strange mother. Nevertheless, Adam and Eve did not mind, as long as it was there for them. The two of them have not been stunted emotionally, because I see that Eve is crying.
"Goodbye, incubation chamber," she says sadly,
rolling the words across her tongue to make them sound really special. If the incubation chamber were able to experience emotions, it would probably break into tears now too. Adam clears his throat.
"Bye, QB,"
he says softly. "QB? I never heard him use that name before. Did he just invent it? Or is it a term of endearment he has been using for a long time?"
"I will always be at your service," the incubation chamber says. "And don't forget to always apply sunblock against the high UV radiation on the surface. Your genes protect you to a certain extent, but you are not completely immune from it."
Adam chuckles, and I have the impression the incubation chamber found the perfect words.
"It is time," I announce. "I'm going to sever all connections to the orbital module."
The process takes a while. Fabricators are crawling through the entire ship, severing electrical cables, closing water pipes, and exhaust air conduits. The command module is turning into a separate spaceship.
"Should we rename the module?" I ask.
"No, that'd be silly," Adam replies. "We're sitting inside Messenger, that's it."
Eve nods in agreement.
"Fine, we won't change it," I say. "Watch out, I'm about to start the engines."
While the fabricators have not yet finished their task, I already lower our trajectory. I cannot go too deep, though, because the orbital module is supposed to maintain a circular course out here for at least 10 years, in case we need it again. We can immediately feel the slight deceleration of the engines, and anything that is not attached moves about inside the module. This is what I had been afraid of. The stuff Adam and Eve brought along needs to be taken care of. Both of them get up, gather the objects tumbling around in the cabin, and tie them down.
"Physical separation completed," the ship's automated system reports.
The fabricators are done, and now split into two groups. In order to save weight, only a third will come with us to the planet, while the others stay in orbit. Once we are on the surface of Proxima B, the fabricators with us will be able to duplicate themselves, as there is no shortage of raw materials.
"Are you ready?"
I ask Adam and Eve. Adam is still rummaging inside his shoulder bag, while Eve has already buckled herself back in.
"Just in case," Adam says.
Eve laughs.
"You'll see,"
Adam replies, and then buckles himself into his seat. I start the control jets, and they are aimed upward into space. The command module moves slowly downward. At this moment, it cannot be more than 2 meters away from the orbital module. Behind us, a loud scratching sound is heard, the orbital module slowly scraping against us. The noise ends after 30 seconds, and we are finally free. Now I can decelerate using the full thrust of the retro engines. I start them and leave the rest to the automatic system. It has already calculated when and for how long we have to decelerate to arrive near the mountain range. I see Adam and Eve grasping their armrests, while inertia pushes their bodies against the safety belts. "I hope we have a smooth landing," I say. But no one answers. It feels strange. We are landing the way it used to be done long ago. I must have landed 10 or 12 times in the steppes of Kazakhstan, in a small capsule hanging below parachutes. The method has been proven reliable, which is why we choose to utilize it here. But back in those days, I was strapped to a couch, shaken around, and felt inertia pressing against my lungs. This time, I'm simultaneously an observer and a commander, and I feel nothing. No pain, no pressure, at most a bit of stress, since that part has not changed. I'm slightly envious of Adam and Eve, and at this moment, I clearly feel that something has been taken from me. "Descent according to plan. T-minus 45. 45 minutes remain. Adam has his eyes closed, and the biomonitor indicates his heart is beating very rapidly. The surface of the planet is quickly approaching, and we are in a phase where the atmosphere decelerates us more than the engines do. The heat shield at the stern, which is now aimed in our direction of flight, is heated by the braking action of the air. 150 degrees. That is less than expected, which is also a bad sign. If the heat shield does not heat up as calculated, this can only mean that the air is not sufficiently decelerating us, probably because the atmosphere is thinner than expected. And if the air does not hit the brakes as much as we had hoped for, planned on, we will be moving faster than we intended. This in turn means we are either going to miss our target region, or we must decelerate in a different way. This different way has to involve the parachutes. However, as long as we are moving too fast, we run the risk that they will not open completely. Damn it. We need to decelerate in order to brake. Otherwise, we are going to land somewhere in the hot zone. Once again, I evaluate our options. If we do nothing, the landing zone will be about 200 kilometers closer to the middle of the continent. The average temperature at that location, 48 degrees. That might be tolerable at rest, but hiking for several days in such heat would be impossible. So we have to use the parachutes. And I check their technical specifications. If we wait another 30 seconds, we will only miss the landing zone by 50 kilometers. There, the average temperature is 40 degrees, and there is a 66% probability of the parachutes opening normally. "Deploy parachutes," I command out loud, so that Adam and Eve will be warned. But they are smart, and they immediately know that something is wrong. Adam tries to get up. "What does he want to do?" I ask myself. I activate the child's safety lock on his seatbelt, and when he realizes this, he angrily smashes his hand against the armrest. We are going to be talking about this later, I am sure, if we survive the present crisis. The parachutes take about 5 seconds to unfold completely, and then a strong jolt can be felt inside Messenger. Now the phase begins that in the past made all cosmonauts reach for their barf bags. The parachutes push against the atmosphere. First, the capsule receives an impulse in its direction of travel. Then it swings back and forth. One gust of wind, and it starts to rotate. The parachute lines are twisted in such a way that they counteract the rotation, and the automatic system tries to regain stability by using the control jets. But at these speeds, it is futile. I hear Adam vomiting first, then Eve. Am I experiencing nausea too? I know it must be a psychological effect, and instead I focus on the sensors. The maneuver was successful, and the landing parabola now runs almost parallel to the original plan. Down here, the atmosphere seems to be slightly thicker than previously measured, so we will overshoot our target by only 30 kilometers. One day's march in the summer heat. At an altitude of 500 meters, the automatic system begins a countdown. It does not really have any purpose other than to make the landing more dramatic. From this point forward, we cannot influence events. Eve wipes her mouth and takes a deep breath. By now, the automatic system has managed to control the rotation of the capsule, and everything seems to indicate a soft landing. "Zero," the computer voice says. At the same moment, the command module rings like a bell. The ground is hard as stone, so we obviously do not experience a soft landing. Adam and Eve are pressed deep into their seats, and then the spaceship bounces. There is a second, less noisy impact, then another jump. The whole time I am anticipating a creaking sound that would indicate the hull is breaking, but Proxima B is merciful. We hit the ground for one last time. I feel the module touch down on the surface. We are sitting at a slight angle. "Everything is fine," I say, out loud, so Adam and Eve won't get scared. The spaceship tilts and then slowly falls forward. Something makes a rattling sound, hitting the side wall, which has now become the roof. It must be one of the parachutes. We have finally arrived. We are at our destination. I hear Adam and Eve breathe sighs of relief. Adam is the first to react. "We made it!" Just like Eve, he is sitting in his pilot seat at an angle. In spite of its flexible attachment, the seat is not able to fully compensate for the tilt of the command module.
"That was really close," Eve says.
A metallic sound can be heard when she unbuckles her belts. Her body slides further sideways. "Let's proceed slowly," I say. "We've got enough time." This is only a half-truth. On the one hand, we should get going in order to reach a more temperate zone in time, while on the other hand, the spaceship does not yet have an airlock that we can use to exit. The fabricators are busy building one at the rear. The fact that Messenger is lying on its side really helps their task. If we had to exit through the hull, they could have only built a hatch instead of an airlock. But the heat shield itself is thick enough for an airlock, offering just enough space for a crouching human. That way, we can preserve the usual atmospheric pressure inside the module. I am curious to see how Adam and Eve will handle the gravity. While they have been training for a part of each day during our journey, they no longer have the option to go into the command module to escape the pull of this force. They will have to spend the next 80, or perhaps 100 years, in it. Both of them possess all the longevity genes that were known at the time the mission was originally launched. Eve is the first to try to get up. She needs the benefits of the exercise program more than Adam. I think I can already determine the high gravity by the way the belt rapidly falls downward. It is strange, because I do not feel anything myself. Eve groans while she gets her torso upright.
"Well, those sit-ups were worth the effort," she says with a smile.
She seems to enjoy this struggle against an invisible opponent. Then Eve pushes her legs from the seat toward the ground. There's a thud when her soles touch the floor.
"So far, so good," she says.
Taking a deep breath, she pushes against the armrest with both of her arms and gets up. The tilted floor does not make it easy for her, but she is finally standing. She takes her arms off the armrests and spreads them.
"Ta-da!"
she announces elatedly. Adam applauds her.
"Don't just watch, do it yourself," Eve says.
She charges wide-legged through the module, supporting herself against the wall with one arm.
"It'd be nice to take a shower now."
"When we reach the mountain range, in a few days," I say. We have some tough days ahead of us. Adam and Eve will have to exchange the comforts of the spaceship for heat, dryness, and constant physical exertion. I hope the fascination of a new beginning will last long enough to make them succeed. I would enjoy physical exercise myself, but I no longer have that option. Interrupting my musings, Eve says,
I've got to pee."
Adam looks around.
"Well, there's some kind of bucket back there you can use," he says, pointing.
Eve gives it a skeptical look.
Of course, you can go outside and pee on the hot sand while Proxima Centauri is burning your naked skin, Adam adds.
Adam is right, I say, although there is no sand out there, at least not at our landing site. However, it is not advisable to expose unprotected skin to UV radiation. You are better protected inside your suits.
Eve crosses her arms.
I am definitely not going to pee into my diaper, she says. Might as well use the bucket then. But don't look.
Adam nods and looks conspicuously ahead.
I'm busy enough trying to get out of my seat, he assures her.
I check our equipment. We have Jay, the robot, who moves on terrain-capable wheels. His arms are designed in such a way that he can also climb well. His interior compartment contains our army of fabricators that can produce almost anything, even copies of themselves, out of almost any materials. The fabricators produce the three individual backpacks to be worn by Jay, Adam, and Eve. These contain everything we need in the near future, or are carrying around for sentimental reasons. For instance, Adam has a doll, a kind of mini Jay that Jay made and gave him for his third birthday. Eve has kept pieces of her baby clothes. She once told me what fascinated her so much about these. It is the idea that her own body fit into these tiny coverings years ago. It made her feel like a butterfly, she said. And then she corrected herself. Like a caterpillar that had not yet reached its final stage.
Oh, Eve, you were always a butterfly.
I regret I did not tell her that back then.
You can look again, Eve announces.
In the meantime, fabricators are already busy putting the organic excretions to new uses. On board Messenger, no material is supposed to be wasted. But this practice will also change in the future. While the spaceship moved through almost empty regions, which always made recycling the better option, Proxima B now offers us more than abundant raw materials. For the fabricators, it will often be more advantageous to gather material nearby than to recycle waste. Organic components will remain valuable as long as we are still walking across the scorching central plains, but by the time we reach the steps, we will find enough of those.
Airlock ready, the ship's automated system reports.
Sadness suddenly overwhelms me. I had not realized how much Messenger had grown dear to my heart. I lived more than 20 years inside it. While we will stay in contact, Jay is going to be my new home, at least for the time we spend traveling. I will also have to say farewell to the quantum computer on board Messenger. Though it would have fit inside Jay, the necessary cooling for it would have required too much effort. I cannot even remember what my consciousness felt like without the quantum computer.
Time to get out, I say.
Eve is the first to stand in front of the airlock. The first step of a human being on a planet outside the solar system, she says, half joking, half seriously. I will be in the history books. Her cheeks are flushed. She places her backpack next to the lock, kneels, and crawls inside backward. Then she closes the door.
Put on your helmet and close it, I warn her.
I want to protect her from being shocked too much when she gets outside. According to the computer, the outer door is now open. Why didn't I go out myself? Then I would not have to worry about her now. There are no cameras on the outside of the hull aimed toward the stern. Eve is all on her own. I hear her groans via the intercom.
It is hot, and I imagined it to be brighter, she says.
According to the biomonitor data, she's doing fine. Her suit's cooling system is managing to compensate for the exterior heat.
Don't let that deceive you, I warn her. Proxima Centauri is not shining very brightly in the visible range, but in infrared and UV, it is much brighter than it would be on Earth.
I know, Eve says, with an annoyed tone of voice. We learned about all that, and I don't care what Earth is like because I've never been there. Now pass me my backpack.
We put her backpack in the airlock.
I hope you did not pack any of the chocolate that the replicators made for us, Adam says.
Eve does not react. Jay transports food in his interior, where it is protected from the heat.
Do you want to take a sniff of the exterior air? I ask.
Definitely, Eve replies.
Her suit starts drawing in air from the outside. Possible germs and poisons are filtered out, and it is enriched with oxygen.
Smells odd.
Could you describe it more closely? I ask. It is logical that the air of the planet would smell strange to Eve. She has been breathing the filtered air of Messenger all her life, except when we did exercises to detect different smells.
It smells a bit, I don't know, rotten? She answers.
I try to coax something out of the analyzer data, but the concentration seems to be too low. Even just a few molecules of a substance can trigger the olfactory center. I'm curious how Eve will react when we reach the fertile zones. I visualize the image of a dark green forest, and there I would lie in the moss, smell the mushrooms, the tree sap, the sun, the soil.
Okay, it's my turn, Adam says.
Oh well, then the captain is going to be the last one to leave the ship, I conclude. I hear a woohoo, and then a cry of pain, which shocks me incredibly, followed by shit.
Adam jumped from the edge of the airlock, Eve says.
He obviously did not take the high gravity into consideration.
I'm still in one piece, I hear Adam say.
How childish of him, I think. Jay first puts Adam's backpack into the airlock, then his own. I am moving my consciousness into Jay's computing unit. It has sufficient capacity, but now it will take me seconds to solve partial differential equations rather than mere microseconds. From this point onward, my voice will sound through the robot's loudspeakers. So far, I have not noticed that I no longer have access to the quantum computer. Jay crouches to get into the airlock. It doesn't look like he will fit into the tube, but his size was a consideration during its construction. Since he is the largest single object we have to get off the spaceship, the airlock was custom-tailored for him, so to speak. Outside, I want to look at Adam and Eve's faces, but the visors of their helmets are slightly reflective.
Are you okay? I ask them.
Both of them nod, yes. They have already put on their backpacks, and the high gravity does not seem to bother them very much. Could they have become used to it so quickly? I call up a map of our route, and notice the mountain range we are trying to reach is in the west. It is easily visible from here. The air is shimmering above the dry, hot plain, and we will have the sun at our back. Proxima B's rotation is tidally locked, so the sun will not leave its place in the firmament. The disk of the star glows white, and it is 2.5 times bigger than the sun is in the sky of Earth. Despite this, it is noticeably darker than during a summer day on Earth, almost as if twilight has already started. The sky itself appears as a dirty blue. Proxima Centauri does not have the right spectrum to produce a shade of blue like the one we see on Earth. I have Jay point to the mountains.
That is our destination, I say. It is about 30 kilometers.
We should be able to reach it before the evening, Adam says.
There is no evening and no night, I remind him. The sun will shine until we reach the Terminator.